This podcast is presented by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at www.uctv.tv. Enjoy the presentation.
Welcome to A Conversation with History. I'm Harry Kreisler of the Institute of International Studies. Our guest today is John Yu, who is professor of law at the University of California at Berkeley Bolt School of Law. He's the author of The Powers of War and Peace and War by Other Means, an insider's account of the war on terror. John, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
Where were you born and raised?
I was born in Seoul, South Korea, and was raised in the Philadelphia area. So I came over from the United States, to the United States when I was 3 months old. Initially grew up in southern New Jersey, then grew up ultimately in the Philadelphia suburbs.
And looking back, how do you think your parents shaped your thinking about the world?
Well, there's a lot of different ways. They were immigrants from another country. I think that was very important to me, the idea that you would leave the country you grew up in and went to school in and go to an entirely different country. It's something I think very hard for Americans to understand. There's not a lot of emigration from America to other countries. So I think one thing is that how strong the pull of the United States is on people in other countries. Second thing is, I think they fled a military dictatorship at the time. South Korea in the 1960s and in the 1970s was a military dictatorship. And so there's a big contrast, I think, between there and the kind of political and economic and social freedoms one has here. And the third one, obviously, Korea is a divided country to this day. And there's this famous shot from space of the Korea Peninsula at night, and you can see the northern half is completely black and the southern half is full of light, as is the Western world. And so one of the last thing I got from my parents, I think, was a sort of deep suspicion of communism and the Soviet Union, and because of that, more sympathy. And when I got older, the American political system of people who did not think that the communists were going to win or were a legitimate political system, and that fighting the expansion of the Soviet Union was a good thing.
Mm-hmm. Was there a discussion of politics, the law, around the dinner table?
No. I'm sorry, I don't have one of those great stories growing up where parents cross-examining the kids about politics and who to vote for. In fact, all I know about my parents' political views is that one of them is a Republican and one of them is a Democrat, but I'm not sure which one is which, and they've never told me. So we didn't talk a lot about, partisan party politics at the table at all. I can't say that my views were shaped at the dinner table or my skills as a lawyer were shaped from arguing with my parents and siblings about politics and the law.
Where did you do your undergraduate work and then your law degree?
I went to Harvard College and I majored in history, American diplomatic history in particular. I wrote my undergraduate thesis about efforts to cooperate in the sharing of nuclear weapons between the United States and Western Europe in the 1960s. And I did my law degree at Yale, where we don't have majors in law school, but I worked primarily in the fields I still do now, constitutional law and international affairs.
And when were you bitten by the bug to look at foreign policy, international law, the power of the president, those set of themes that run throughout your work?
Actually, that comes all the way from middle school. One part of it is just, having come from Korea, being an immigrant, and coming from a place where the United States fought and drew in one of its Cold War battles. So that sort of course, what made me sort of interested in the beginning. The second thing is I went to a school in middle school and high school that heavily emphasized Western civilization and the study of the classics. So I read a lot about Greek and Roman sources and the histories, which are a lot of it is about what we would think of today as foreign affairs, politics, military, and so on. And so I was interested in even before I got to college. And then when I got to college, I got to study a lot of different aspects of international relations and domestic, but as it interacted with the American domestic system. And then law school, you know, sort of more finely narrowed that down, you know, to really the legal aspects of that.
Did you have any professors either as an undergraduate or at law school who heavily influenced you?
Yes. In college, I was heavily influenced by two professors who, and it's probably the normal course at Harvard, neither of them are there anymore. And one was Thomas Schwartz, who's a professor of history now at Vanderbilt, who's was a real student of the German Reconstruction period after World War II, and is just last, I think 2 years ago, came out with this book about Lyndon Johnson in Europe. The other professor I was close to is Brian Ballow, who's a professor of history at Virginia, and he was a student of the American administrative state. And so actually, you think about those two interests, I had sort of combined from those two areas. In law school, I was sort of the people I was closest to, Peter Schuck, who's been many times to UC Berkeley and probably be back again, a student of administrative law, Harold Coase, a foreign affairs, and Akilah Marr, who really studied the Constitution from an originalist perspective. And so, again, all three of those are, continue to be influences on my work today.
How were you affected by the Reagan Revolution, or were you?
You know, I, given the kind of milieu I think I came out of, I was very supportive of President Reagan's policies, particularly in foreign affairs. I think the idea that the Soviet Union was an evil empire, it was an evil system, and the United States was appropriately trying to defeat it, not just reach some state of coexistence with it, but to actually win in the Cold War, is very attractive to me. And you know, Carter was really the president I was really conscious of. And you know, there's a sharp difference between the two. And I really thought Reagan had foreign policy about right. Domestic policy, I sort of like the idea of lower tax cuts. I mean, more tax cuts, lower government intervention in society, more space for sort of private activity. People sometimes find it odd that I'm a libertarian when it comes to domestic social issues as opposed to foreign affairs. However, Reagan did not cut spending, which what he should have done. But other than that, the other aspects of his policy I thought were, I very much agreed with.
In one of the books or one of the articles I read, it mentioned that you, the Federalist Society, that you joined that when you really were only eight members.
Yeah.
It was made up of conservatives and libertarians, I think it said. Right. So there's this dichotomy in the conservative in what we came to think of as the conservative movement, and also in your own thinking.
Oh yeah, there is this. I mean, people sort of maybe generally don't realize it, but within what's thought of as the conservative legal movement, there is a deep division between libertarians who are just relatively suspicious of government power in any form, no matter what level of government it is, and I would think of as sort of more social conservatives or big government conservatives, which is also runs through the Republican Party too, and there's no resolution of it. And one thing the Federalist Society is good about is that it provides a forum to those two groups to debate things. One great issue that they debate about and disagree about is sort of wiretapping, for example, and the war on terrorism. So there's no sort of unified view amongst legal conservatives.
During this formative experience, there was a lot of energy in the conservative movement. I mean, it was an exciting time to become a conservative. That's fair, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's sort of interesting. Right? The dominant the dominant way of thought at that time was still, I think, fairly liberal. And so if you were a conservative, particularly at a place like Harvard or Yale or any major university at that time, the conservatives were sort of more the radicals, I guess they were, right? They were trying to overturn the way that sort of way things had been going for some time. So, yeah, it was more exciting. I mean, the people involved were maybe younger. They had the fresher and newer ideas. They were more fun to debate about them, whereas, sort of what I think of as a liberal orthodoxy that had really been a product of the New Deal, and then Roosevelt, you know, and Johnson and Carter seemed tired and defensive.
Mm-hmm. You've been fortunate to have a number of legal mentors. Judge Silberman first, mm-hmm. Then Justice Thomas, mm-hmm. and then you also worked for Orrin Hatch. Mm-hmm. Talk a little about each of them briefly and how they influenced you, because they really gave you a view of both national security issues, mm-hmm. you know, conservative legal scholarship, and then finally the view from the Congress.
Yeah, I learned a great deal from all three of them. They've all been very influential mentors of mine. Judge Silberman is the first person I ever had a real job under. You know, you serve as a law clerk, which means you're their assistant. You help the judge research cases. If they want you to find what the law is in some subject, you go find it. You help them prepare for oral argument. You know, basically, you know, a research assistant, basically, in the way you have professors have them. And he was really good for me because he was someone who combined those things I was interested in. He had been an ambassador. He was ambassador to Yugoslavia. And he's continued to be a figure in foreign affairs and national security, even though he's a judge and a lawyer. He's not a sort of pure policy person, but someone trained in law. So you know, even just a few years ago, he was the joint chairman of the President's Commission on the WMD in Iraq mm-hmm. study. So he continues to play that role. So that was very important to me to see that the things I was interested in could lead to a career mm-hmm. and to see how he thought things through. He was the first real lawyer I worked for, too. Justice Thomas is also a very influential person in the way I thought, or way I think. He taught me a number of things. One thing he taught me was not to really worry so much about criticism. I mean, he really thinks the key thing in any of these things we do is to reach what you think is the right answer. Mm-hmm. And if you think it's the right answer, then defend it. And not to be so swayed by criticism. Not that you don't pay attention to what other people's arguments and views are, but you consider them all, and then you make your decision, and then you live with it. And you don't sort of sway back and forth based on criticism. And so he's been criticized a lot. He's one of the most criticized public figures. And I think what I saw was a person who continued to do his job and to continue to stand up for what he believed in. Senator Hatch, again, I was very lucky, again, to work for a wonderful guy and someone who taught me about how politics works. And so what I've always often said to students is that you know, we can prepare you in law school how to be a judicial clerk. I think you can get prepared in law school or graduates how to work in the executive branch. And I don't think, and no offense to political scientists or to lawyers, I don't think we have a clue how to teach people how to work in Congress. Mm-hmm. And it's just you can't have a class on, you know, Congress 101 that really tells you what a lobbyist does and how you would do it, how you would be a staffer, how you work things through the political process in Congress. You know, what are hearings really like? You know, how do you run? And so of all the jobs I've actually had, I think I learned the most from Senator Hatch in that 1 year I worked for him, because there's no way right now we can effectively teach that experience in the classroom.
Which leads me to my next question. What do you think it takes to do the kind of law that you do? I mean, it's not mm-hmm. tort law. It's not yeah. contracts. It's really sort of the Constitution, international relations, mm-hmm. internet. It's a very hard thing to get your hands on. So, in my view. Well, so yeah.
In the law schools, what they would say, it's a hard thing to bill hours for.
I see.
In the sense that you don't,
so you go work
you don't
for
obviously
the
make money. Yeah, you know, there's yeah. no law firms that have a practice in yeah. foreign affairs law. Right?
That's it.
Right.
So what yeah. does it take yeah. to do that? Yeah. Idealism, I
yeah.
guess?
Well, first of all, I think, you know, it's you're not going to make a lot of money if you go into that kind of mm-hmm. work. And most of the work is in the government. There's, again, corporate, you know, to the extent companies might get involved in it, it's really to the extent they're multinational companies and they run across issues. But the things I'm concerned about, war powers, treaty powers, and so on, don't really arise that much in private practice. So the only real way to get experience in it and to learn about it is by doing it, mm-hmm. working in it. So I've had the opportunity to work in all three branches of the government and to see these kinds of issues from each of those different perspectives. And there's a lot of jobs, not a lot, but there are a good number of jobs in the government, in the federal government, that involve these kinds of issues. But outside of that, there really isn't much. So it's hard for me to tell students to go into this as a line of work. I mean, we can teach them the issues and the class, but you know, they're not. It's going to be very hard to get actual jobs that where you work on this every day.
Let's talk now to where you found yourself at the time of 9/11, because as I was preparing for this interview, it struck me that you were present at the creation, in a way, and you were in the Bush administration. You had a position at Berkeley, and you were on leave. So in the summer of 2001, what was the position you took up, and what does that position do?
So I was in the Office of Legal Counsel. I was a deputy in the Office of Legal Counsel. That office functions to provide legal advice, constitutional issues mostly, but also statutory issues to the executive branch, because many people, you know, sort of public in the public world don't really realize it, but the courts only end up interpreting a fairly small proportion of the law. The executive branch has to enforce the law, and when it does that, it has to figure out what the law means in the first place. So the Office of Legal Counsel functions as sort of the office within the entire government that is sort of a court of final appeal to those kinds of questions within the presidency and the agencies, and also serves as sort of a advisor on the law to the president and the White House. I was hired to be in charge of the foreign affairs docket within that office. It's a very small office, only has about 20 to 30 people in it. If you go back to that world, the pre-9/11 world, this was not an administration that was going to place a lot of importance or emphasis on foreign affairs. Right? Mm-hmm. It was emphasizing tax cuts and faith-based initiatives and so on. So it wasn't thought that this was going to be particularly important or heavy job. There weren't, I don't think, a great number of national security specialists or in the administration or in the Justice Department. So at 9/11, I was at my desk. I was I think I was working on fairly mundane, routine things. So I was at my desk, and I saw the second, on television, I saw the second plane hit the World Trade Center towers. And I stayed there. Most of, if I remember, Washington was evacuated, which was an incredible sight. Since I worked on these issues, I had to stay. And I stayed there probably until 2 or 3 in the morning. But it was a very strange experience. To go out and get something to eat for lunch, I couldn't find anything. I mean, Washington was a ghost town. It was completely empty. All the stores were shut. And driving home that night was an incredible sight that I never thought I would see in our lifetime. I mean, I drove over the 14th Street Bridge, which is the main bridge leading out of Washington to Virginia, where I lived, and it goes right by the Pentagon, and you drove by, and the night sky is lit up by the huge fire at the Pentagon. I never thought I'd live to see the day where a capital, you know, part of our capital is on fire.
Did you realize right away how important the research that you had been doing was? Because I believe, and let me show this first book of yours, which I guess actually is the second book to come out, or I'm not sure.
First one.
The first, The Powers of War. You were working on this book before you went to Washington, right? So you were, and in this book you're really grappling with a new interpretation of what are the powers of the president.
Yeah, during the 90s, my primary area of scholarly activity was this war powers question. The one we've been debating since well before the Vietnam War, but the Vietnam War is really when it became most prominent, was does the president have the authority to use force abroad without Congress's authorization, without a declaration of war or any other kind of authorization? And you're right, I think what I had to argue was new in the sense that most legal scholars, most of the prominent ones at this time, and probably continue to today, still.
And Harold Coe is one of them, one of your teachers.
Was probably one of the leading people in this, takes this position, or the view that the president acts unconstitutionally unless he or she gets the permission of Congress through a declaration of war or a statute to wage a war abroad. I started working on that in 1993. That's when I first started doing it. And, you know, the 90s were a period when no one thought there'd be any wars anymore and that this would be kind of a backwater of constitutional work. The other thing I just point out is this is an area where the practice is very much at odds with the academic consensus. Mm-hmm. You look at, certainly since World War II, if not before, been several wars, some very significant ones like Korea itself, which didn't have any kind of congressional authorization. So, yeah, this is something I was working on before 9/11. I believe I'd signed the contract to publish this book before I went off into government. I had not planned to go into government in 2001, so my plan had probably this book would have come out in 2002.
Mm-hmm. And during your theory, you're essentially in the book. Let's talk briefly about that. You're looking at the record of practice, the imperatives of a dangerous world, and the structural advantages of the executive branch. Those are the three things that you're identifying as truly important. And when you did that, and you brought what I guess one would call a conservative perspective or a new way of thinking, which is or is not conservative, you essentially came up with an argument about the president's power and the Congress power. What is that argument?
Well, first let me say this isn't really, in my view, a conservative versus liberal view in the sense that Franklin Roosevelt certainly, I think, would have agreed with me. Mm-hmm. And Republicans at that time were quite critical of Roosevelt or Truman and a Republican Congress or Johnson. So I don't really think it follows a conservative liberal thing historically, although it certainly does now. So the basic view is this. I don't think the Constitution in the area of war powers is so straitjacketed that it requires a step-by-step process, like a dual-key launch system on a submarine where the president can't turn his key until Congress turns his key, and that this is all set out in the Constitution. Rather, I think the Constitution has a flexible process. Either branch can act on its own, take the initiative. Also means either branch can try to stop the other branch using its own powers, and that there's nothing wrong with that, that the constitutional system actually anticipates, if not intends, that there to be some conflict between the executive and legislative branches, between the president and Congress, over something like war. But what I didn't think it was this kind of legalistic process where, like passing a law. And I think that makes sense because that would make the most sense if you had the other elements that you mentioned, that you had a world that was dangerous, you would want the government to be able to act flexibly and quickly if it needed to. If future challenges were going to be uncertain, you would want to have, again, an executive can take the initiative and Congress can choose to support him. Congress can also block him if it wants to. But I emphasize constitutional flexibility. The interesting thing about this is the critics of practice had always base their arguments in the original understanding of the Constitution, which is not a familiar home to these kinds of scholars in almost any issue. So I think what my contribution was to say the practice that has been going on in this country for many, many decades is not actually inconsistent with the original view of the Constitution. Mm-hmm. The Constitution originally was written to be flexible, so you can harmonize the two. Otherwise, the view has to be that there have been many, many presidents over many decades, including most of our great presidents, who have been acting unconstitutionally in all of these areas.
When you look at the specifics, and I think this is important, in a way that you're very clearly saying, look, if the Congress wants to stop a war, they can cut off the funding,
yeah,
basically.
Like you. Yeah.
And then on the other hand, really the president can just take an action, and really he really doesn't need a declaration of war. In the case of fighting al-Qaeda and in the case of the Iraq War, Bush went to the Congress, but he really didn't have to do that.
That's right. Yeah, yeah. I would say the Korean War or any number of things, Lincoln's response to the Civil War or, as you said, the Iraq War or war in Afghanistan, I don't think the president constitutionally needed to get or the Kosovo War, the president didn't need to constitutionally get the permission of Congress. On the other hand, only Congress could provide the funds for any of those wars to go on. And that, in my view, remains Congress's ultimate check. So if Congress really wants to end the war in Iraq, they can do it. they pass. In fact, it's very easy to do. They don't even have to pass a law. All they have to do is not pass anything, right? Because military appropriations come up with this war not just every year, sometimes several times a year. And the Congress just stopped and said, we're not going to vote you anything. We're going to sit passively on our heels and just watch. Mm-hmm. Then the war would have to end.
And this raises an interesting question that really recurs throughout your work, and that is the legal dimension and the political dimension. And so the political realities are that Congress isn't going to use that power. Even probably if you had a majority of Democrats in both the House, you know, and the Senate. So I guess I'm curious about your sense of your role, because as in the administration, being aware of, you know, the theories that you had developed, they're really, what is the play here between, because you, in your job, you set about writing a number of memos, you know, based on these principles. And I guess the important question is, how does our system respond negatively to actions of the president if the Congress and the courts' power is so circumscribed?
Well, you know, again, I don't think their power is circumscribed in so as a formal matter.
But as a matter of politics.
As a matter of politics, they choose not to use it. And one point I really try to make in the book is that because groups or people or institutions don't use the powers at their hand, doesn't mean we have to reinterpret the Constitution itself to force them to do it. You know, if they don't want, if Congress or a court doesn't want to try to check the executive, then that's their decision. But that doesn't mean the Constitution's broken. So just one point. So the second thing is, in terms of just the being an academic in government, I think is really your question. Well, at the one hand, I might say, and I think this has been the consistent view of the Justice Department across many presidents, that I might think that the president has the authority to respond to al-Qaeda without any congressional permission. On the other hand, as a policy matter, I was one of the small team that worked with the Congress to get them to pass such an authorization, both with regard to Afghanistan and Iraq. So you're right. My constitutional view is one thing, but it may be politically better for the Bush administration to get permission from Congress or authorization from Congress anyway. And that's what I did.
There was an interview you did with Frontline, and I was really struck by this quote, and I think it relates to what we're talking about right now. This was something you said at the end of the interview. I think one of the things I did notice in a lot of these debates is that a lot of people thought or wanted the law to have already made the choice for them. That's the thing that was very interesting to me. I think people in the public and some members of the military, the agencies, they think that all this should be decided by the law, that the law really tells you exactly how to treat enemy prisoners, and it does when you're fighting another nation state. What I think made them more uncomfortable was the newness of the conflict, the sort of radicalism of this unprecedented enemy. So in a way, you're sort of admitting that you're sort of sheepishly, I think, here, that you were in a way surprised by the impact of the memos you were writing. Or were you? Is that a fair
read? No, actually, I think what I was trying to say there and what I think still is that what struck me is that with the war on terrorism, not so much the war in Iraq, you know, which is a sort of standard nation-state war, but in the war on terrorism, you had a situation where this is a new kind of enemy, and the conflict is different. And people within the executive branch were very reluctant to ask, well, really, do the rules that we have developed for the kinds of wars we know, the wars between nation states covered by the Geneva Conventions, do they really apply here or not? And people did not want to think about that question, even though I think it seemed clear to me, and I think clear to a lot of other people, that legally the Geneva Conventions didn't apply. That doesn't tell you, if they don't apply, that doesn't tell you one way or the other whether you should apply the rules of the Geneva Conventions as a matter of policy. And there are people who thought, well, since it must, we want to follow it as a matter of policy, therefore I have to go back and read the law in some way to find it to apply to conflict with Al-Qaeda. So I think the law there is used as a way not to make decisions, right? To say, oh, the law has already made this choice for us, when I don't think it really has. And that makes it harder, right? If the law hasn't really already made the decision for you, then it's harder to figure out because you have to reach the policy decision of your own and take responsibility for it.
Now, in a democracy, what we believe is in an open debate, and because so many of these memos, some of which you authored, were really secret for quite a while, it prevented a kind of vigorous debate so that the politics didn't happen in the short term. So it's an interesting conundrum here. You get you get legal decisions by you with a particular perspective, but nobody knows about them, basically, and because the political debate didn't occur, so there could be policy made on the basis of, well, you know, this is what the law says, but...
Yeah, I think that's a fair point and a difficult problem. And again, example, this is always a problem in war, it seems to me, but it's a even greater problem in this war than in previous wars, which is when you fight a war, you have to take measures in secret. You have to act swiftly and secretly and decisively, in the words of the Federalist Papers. That can be at odds with the idea that you have full, robust debate over policy options, right? To just take a standard answer, right? You know, was there a full, robust public debate in the United States in 1941 and 42 about whether to emphasize Europe over the Pacific as the major field of battle against the Axis powers? I don't think there really ever was. You know, you certainly didn't until much later have public all the kinds of plans and strategic thinking of the Roosevelt administration. Because, right, there's obvious harm that premature disclosure of that information can have in helping the enemy. In a way, it doesn't when you're talking about tax cuts or domestic spending. And so that's basically a problem, I think, in all wars. It's especially a problem in this kind of conflict because the enemy is almost acting entirely covertly. So the kind of information that we're dealing with is primarily intelligence. It's not... reconnaissance. It's not the kind of methods you usually use to gain information on the enemy if the enemy was, say, Germany or Russia. And because of that, the kinds of discussions could have negative consequences in terms of our ability to succeed in fighting a covert enemy. So, you know, to give you one example about wiretapping, right? If you were to say, you know, we need to have a discussion about wiretapping because we want to tap this kind of communication, then Al-Qaeda will respond quite quickly and stop using that form of communication. And this is not an idle hypothesis. In the 90s, I talk about it in another book, in the 90s, the government got the ability to actually intercept Osama bin Laden's personal cell phone calls, which I think is extraordinary. And in the course of a trial from the first World Trade Center bombing by Al-Qaeda, I believe the government leaked that it had this ability, I think probably to show eventually that it knew, it could trace back that Osama bin Laden had actually ordered the bombing. But within 24 hours that Osama bin Laden stopped using that cell phone, which would only obvious and rational thing for him to do, and never used one again. So they monitor our discussion, which is easy to do through the internet, and they react fairly quickly.
When one looks at these memos, it's very clear that you were really present at the creation, and that you had to define a new set of terms in a way. You had already written, I think, or had thought about the problem of weapons of mass destruction, terrorist organizations. The whole notion of rogue states, you know, is kind of defining a new world. But one of the challenges, I guess, you had were to define terms such as a terrorist organization. What is torture? And so, and talk a little about that. I mean, did you have clients here to help you come up with these definitions? That is, clients within the government?
Well, even before you get to those things, the first term of definition is whether it was war,
yeah.
In fact, which I think still continues to be the, at root, the basic area of disagreement about people who criticize or agree with the current administration's terrorism policies, whether it's a war at all.
Mm-hmm.
But then you have to talk about who's really legitimately a member of the enemy. You know, what force can you use against them? How long can you detain them? How can you try them? How can you interrogate them? You're right. All those questions come up in a way they haven't come up before, because this is not a nation state, and because of the way they fight. They don't come up abstractly. So, I mean, as a professor or an academic, you like to think, oh, the government sort of, at the very beginning, thought coherently about everything, mm-hmm. and sort of applied basic principles throughout. But, you know, in the government, it doesn't really work that way. In the government, these issues sort of come up piecemeal based on specific questions of policy or specific legal questions that are put to you by other agencies. So one thing about the place I worked is that's not a proactive agency in the sense, we just sort of declared on September 12th, we have to rethink everything and this is how we're going to do it. It's not really a policymaking arm. It's more of it's more reactive. Other agencies that had to confront these kinds of questions in the course of fighting the war on terrorism came back and asked us what our best opinion was. And so they may lack a certain kind of sort of comprehensiveness or cohesiveness from issue to issue that sort of academics or scholars or people would like, but that's because that's the nature, the government deals with the problems as they arise. One side thing. The other thing about government work that was really surprising to me is how, and I think we don't really understand as academics, you know, as academics we can spend years studying one decision mm-hmm. made by the government. We can collect collect immense amounts of information, rethink all the different possibilities and consequences and weigh them. The thing that's very hard to understand for us is that in the government has to make decisions under extraordinary pressures of time, extremely limited information, and so it still has to make a decision. It doesn't have the luxury of full analysis that one would prefer. And war only makes it worse because it compresses the time, and the consequences of a wrong decision are much higher than I think they are for, again, a question of social policy or domestic policy.
This question about what was the nature of this war and whether we were at war seems to be pivotal. And I have never understood the notion of a war on terror. Mm-hmm. It's sort of like a war on airplanes or something. Mm-hmm. Was that a political decision that mucks up the legal sphere?
Yeah, I agree with what you're suggesting. I think the war, calling it the war on terrorism, is a rhetorical device that I think speechwriters probably came up with the night of September 11th probably, or September 12th. It's very much at odds, I think, with the way we have to understand the war as a legal matter or a constitutional matter. I quite agree that we can't really be at war with what is at base just a way of fighting, right? It's a method of fighting terrorism. We couldn't be at war with kamikazes, right? What we are at war with has to be an entity of some kind. I think that's caused a lot of problems because people say, well, we don't really use wartime methods on drugs. We don't, but we have war on drugs, and we have war on crime. We have war on poverty. We don't use the military. We don't use force. We don't detain, and so on. But I think this is different. I think we are at war legally with al-Qaeda and the groups that are supporting and helping al-Qaeda, and anybody else who is connected with the 9/11 attacks. And I think the law can help us define what that conflict is. But yeah, when you say war on terror, then you're sort of blurring that lines. And I think it causes people unnecessary concern about the steps that the government's legitimately entitled to undertake.
Mm-hmm. One of the controversies about the memos that you wrote relates to torture. And, again, I don't know that these are have been released in the public domain. But, you know, the memo that you wrote is quoted as saying that physical pain amounted to torture must be equivalent in intensity to the pain accompanying serious physical injury, such as organ failure, impairment of bodily function, or even death. For purely mental pain or suffering to amount to torture, under U.S. law, it must result in significant psychological harm of significant duration, that is, last for months or for years. These opinions, this memo became very controversial, and I want to take it to actually talk about kind of broader issues. I'm not a constitutional or international law scholar, so what I want to ask you about is, in doing the writing of these memos, did your philosophy about the president's power and how it really isn't constrained in a time of war lead you to come up with narrower definitions of the particular issue, or was that really what you found in the law?
In that case, in the language you quoted, it doesn't. The hard thing about that problem is that Congress prohibits torture in a criminal statute, but it doesn't give much definition to what torture is. And the job of the executive branch is try to get some objective meaning mm-hmm. that's not based just on what one person versus another person might think it is. So we may all have very different definitions of it. And it used, unfortunately, I think, vague terms. Didn't give examples. For mm-hmm. you know, it didn't point to cases and so on. It used language that was torture is severe physical pain or suffering, basically, is about it. And so the language actually you read, it was one that was drawn from other statutes that Congress had passed where it had defined what's severe physical pain or suffering.
That was, and it was domestic legislation.
Yes, domestic legislation. Didn't have to do with foreign affairs.
Yeah.
But, you know, you try to read all of Congress's statutes coherently as one body of law. And it was in an area about emergency medical treatment. Mm-hmm. But it was the only other area of law we could find where Congress had defined. Mm-hmm. The thing that was lacking is this had never come up in an American court. Mm-hmm. So there was no definite interpretation of that law by any judicial decision, which would be another a normal place you would look to find some definition. So in all of that, what we did, I thought, was sort of standard approaches to figure out what a vague law or a law of first impression that no one's interpreted means. And in fact, we also looked at the experience of the Israelis, the British. You know, their courts had interpreted mm-hmm. The definition between torture and non-torture, too. Later in the memo, the view about presidential power does come up, not as to the definitions, but when we're asked what would actually happen if the president had ordered an interrogation method, which later people thought actually mm-hmm. did cross the line. And in that circumstance, you know, my view was that and it continues to be, that Congress can't use the criminal law to prevent the president from using his constitutional authorities to make a decision. Mm-hmm. And that we had historically, as a country and under the Constitution, given to the president the control over battlefield tactics, battlefield strategies, and that Congress had never really tried to interfere with those. So that, again, this doesn't mean Congress can't use any of its other powers, funding, investigation, oversight, ultimately impeachment, to constrain a president that he or she, that Congress disagrees with. But I don't think what it can do is say, you know, if the president uses one of his powers in a way we don't like, it's actually violation of the criminal law. Mm-hmm. That actually brings me around back, I think, to a question you asked me at the beginning about Reagan. That was a problem I thought existed under the Reagan administration, was that you had what I think of as the criminalization of policy disputes between the president and Congress. And that's what I thought would happen here if such a hypothetical arose. Now, you know, in the end, it was my view that that didn't happen, that the president did not cross that line. So that part of the memo, which is also heavily criticized, didn't actually become operative. You know, it didn't become relevant to the actual policies that were later decided on.
In your book, you really see the president as preeminent in deciding what treaties mean, mm-hmm. basically, and even abrogating those treaties. And mm-hmm. you limit Congress to the role of the implementation through domestic legislation. And I guess that's a prelude to what I hear in all of this, which is that a lot of this was very bad politics. That wasn't your domain, but, you know, in the sense that if you have a narrow definition like this and it's kept secret and then it leaks, mm-hmm. you know, the response of the international community to what is being said and so on. So there's a whirlwind of negativity that's just lying in wait to suddenly spring out.
Harry, I completely agree with you, and I wouldn't deny that those thought I wasn't thinking about those kinds of things, mm-hmm. in the sense that if someone was concerned about the political dimensions of these kinds of decisions, the safest thing to do would be to just do what we used to do and not make any great change of policy. Right? If you didn't want to get any criticism at all, the safest thing to do would just be to say Geneva Conventions apply, every member of Al-Qaeda is a prisoner of war, and so on. It would be the risk-averse political choice. I think, however, maybe it requires putting oneself back in the time of 9/11 and the media aftermath, the pressures on the government to stop another 9/11 attack were very high. It's very hard to remember, I think, today, particularly here out here in California, mm-hmm. what it was like. And so you have this, I think, competing value that runs against that, which is trying to take those measures in a balanced way, not in an overly aggressive way, to try to make sure another terrorist attack like 9/11 doesn't happen. You know, everyone thought there'd be another one in fairly short order, and the government has been fairly successful in stopping them. But you're quite right. I think the politics of it, anybody could have foreseen if they thought about it, that, yeah, you're going to take these measures, and when they become public, as they all do eventually, it will be extremely controversial, and you will suffer negative political costs for them. No doubt about it.
Is there a problem here in the sense that we haven't really thought through a lot of these definitions? Because where these definitions, and I'm being vague here, but this is what we'll call the Bush response and the legal memorandum that went with it, that there is a notion here of war 24/7. Mm-hmm. And if you live with that mm-hmm. over time, then a lot of what we think and know and appreciate about our system doesn't seem to be operative, mm-hmm. basically. Intrusion on people's privacy, the notion that, you know, power is always balanced in our mm-hmm. system. So there are general views that we have, I being a layman, the mm-hmm. layman out in our audience, of what our system is about, that indirectly becomes discredited, basically, by the impact of all of this, the notion that war is 24/7, the president can do anything, and so on.
Well, I would look at it a little differently, obviously. I would say that, yes, this is a new kind of war, and it does require rethinking of some basic concepts and also of how we approach war from in sense of managing it and deciding issues about it domestically. It doesn't. I don't think it requires. It has this sort of the huge sort of political consequences that people worry about, and your question expresses worry about, in the sense that if you look at where we've been since 9/11, we have had sort of the normal operation, I would think, of the political process. You know, we're about to have our second presidential election, and several congressional elections. I don't think there's been any real distortion in the political process. You look at, the working of the economy, you look at, normal social activity, they seem not to be that dramatically affected if you compare it to past wars. So I think that's, I kind of think of it as, think of it in terms of another discipline in a way, which is medicine, in the sense that what you've got to do to fight Al-Qaeda is you have to actually be much more precise and surgical in the way you fight them so that you don't affect the whole body of the body politic. Mm-hmm. Whereas in previous wars, you had much more aggressive and wide-ranging measures that are taken by the government. You compare this to World War II, World War I, or the Civil War, and what happened domestically in terms of civil liberties and privacy, I think was far worse than anything that's happened today. I just think people don't remember the history or don't study mm-hmm. what happened in those previous conflicts. I quite agree. We would lose the war if we actually took those measures in mm-hmm. response to terrorism today. Mm-hmm. So the job of, I think the administration's done a much better job than people give credit for of fighting this war, but at the same time trying to preserve as much of normal peacetime civil liberties as possible, and not really erring as far over as, say, Lincoln or Roosevelt or Wilson had.
Mm-hmm. One sense that I was left with in reading your books is, and I want to be judicious here, but a kind of naivete about the way bureaucracies work. Of course, you're here at the university, so you have some familiarity with that.
The bureaucracy here is far worse than anything that exists in Washington, okay. I assure you.
But the idea that if, for example, if we look at the example of the torture memo and how, you know, certain clients of your office, namely the CIA, even in the military, that the kind of breakdowns you witnessed in Iraq and having to do with the transfer of a limited use, say, in Guantanamo, to a broader war in Iraq that was a very different situation. Mm-hmm. Talk a little about that. And is that just a problem that lawyers have generally as a rulemaker?
I think it's difficult because when you work in the office of justice, your job is to interpret the law and to say, here's the law, mm-hmm. here are the rules it sets. And within those rules, you know, sort of like saying, here are the lines of the football field. And within those lines, you play the game. We're not going to tell you how you play the game, but you can't go beyond those rules. And what the job of that department had not traditionally been was then to implement the rules too. Mm-hmm. There's a separation between interpreting the law and developing and prosecuting the policies within the rules that you have set out. And so to the extent there is any kind of problem in the implementation, right, I think your question is, well, you may have decided these policies and they may have made sense in the abstract. You didn't take account of the fact that there are going to be problems in the implementation, that people will violate the rules or they'll go too far. And again, this is not unusual in the sense that if you compare it to domestic society, you know, we have very clear rules about what police can do. Yet we have thousands of cases every year in the federal court system, the state courts, is about police who go too far, right? Or prison guards who go too far. And it is a problem about how do you make sure that those agents of the government follow the rules, and how do you create a system to correct errors? Mm-hmm. And so, you know, thinking about, you know, the sort of my scholar's hat on, I suppose, your question can be translated in this idea that, well, you did not anticipate how high the errors would be. Mm-hmm. And you would have to think about, well, what would the system to correct those errors look like, and how much would it cost, right? And what's the benefit of following the rules you set out? I mean, you may have errors. We have errors in bureaucratic systems mm-hmm. in the United States, in the university all the time, but there are costs we live with in order to get the benefits or whatever it is. So those are all variables to think of. I have to say, in the writing on these issues, that really isn't something the memos were about or designed to do. Mm-hmm. And in some ways, as a lawyer, would not have been my job, or I've been going too mm-hmm. far if I had said, here I'm interpreting this law, but here are these other things you better be worried about. It wouldn't be part of the job of that office. It might be advice one could give, you know, but doesn't have anything to do with law, and my view wouldn't be entitled to any kind of special value as opposed to anyone else in the government on those issues. In fact, I might be someone who's less qualified to mm-hmm. advise someone about that, because my specialization is just interpreting the law here, not figuring out how do you actually now make it work in mm-hmm. practice.
You wrote in this book, The War by Other Means, which I guess I should show. I never showed our audience, which is an account of your experience. You wrote, I think,
my publishers, although they're different, they all like to stick stars on the book covers.
I see. You wrote upon confrontation and questioning of its policies, the Bush administration tended to run and hide. I have a sense that you say, okay, this is what I think. You know, my scholarship tells me this, my political inclinations, and you would incline more toward the airing of these things, so there should be a debate, and that the political process would then maybe retreat from what you thought was the best.
I agree. I think a big problem in a lot of these war on terrorism issues is it's not just that initially there wasn't debate, but then after a period of time you could have debate, obviously. And I think the administration sort of ceded the field to its critics. I think the administration has very good reasons for a lot of the policies it reached. But if you read the press and you sort of follow the public debate, you would think that these are the most irrational, arbitrary decisions just made to aggrandize the power of the president or the vice president. And I don't think that's the case at all. I think these are, and I think it's an illusion to think they're easy. I think these are very hard questions, and there are costs and benefits to every decision you make. And I think the administration just doesn't explain itself very well, or chose, I think, on the Geneva Conventions and the interrogation issue, chose not to explain at all. Mm-hmm. And I think only when it came down to the wiretapping cases did the administration really start coming out and explaining why it did what it did, why it thought it could do that. And then we also started learning later that, the executive branch was actually secretly briefing and consulting with members of Congress about all of these things, mm-hmm. to try to get some kind of, in response to one of your previous questions, how do you deal with this? You have wartime pressures, but you have a government that's supposed to openly disclose policy choices. And, you know, what the administration clearly tried to do was to not have the information become public so it would help the enemy, but at the same time try to have some kind of sort of political consultation by secretly talking to leaders of Congress. But I agree, that doesn't substitute for a full-bore, robust public discussion, and I don't understand why you wouldn't have it once it's already become public. But that's what they did, and I think that's a big problem and sort of a self-inflicted wound that the administration has suffered.
One final question requiring a brief answer because we're running out of time. But, my sense of American politics is the pendulum swings back the other way over time, liberal, conservative, mm-hmm. whatever. Do you see that happening here, and what will be the consequences mm-hmm. for both the country and actually for the people who are involved in these decisions?
Yeah, it's a very interesting question. I think after Vietnam, right, you saw, mm-hmm. and the Nixon administration, you saw a weakening of executive power. The thing that's, I think, fairly striking is that it actually lasted a fairly short period of time. I mean, it lasted the rest of Nixon's administration, which was under President Ford, and then the Carter administration, one term. And then by the Reagan administration, you have a lot of people in the political system wanting a return to a vigorous executive. So it's certainly possible that dissatisfaction with the war, although I think it's primarily the war in Iraq and not the war on terrorism that's causing the greater dissatisfaction, will produce a shift away from executive power. But I think it's going to return, not because I happen to favor it that way, or I think it's because of the complexity of the world and foreign challenges, and the threat of terrorism is not going away, and we're not going to have a Congress manage that day to day in the details. It's still going to be the job, and always going to be the job, of the executive branch.
John, I want to thank you very much for being with us today, and I want to show your two books because I think they should be read, because you are fearless in your willingness to discuss the issues that were raised by 9/11 and the response of the Bush administration. Thank you very much for coming on our program.
Thank you, Harry. It's a pleasure.
And thank you very much for joining us for this Conversation with History.
You've been listening to a podcast from University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at www.uctv.tv. Thank you for listening.